Wednesday, 17th of July. The Facebook post shows Brooke Ripley in a white, fitted, ankle-length dress and silver trainers. She looks pensive in the photo, fragile and unsure. It's only because Alex knows that a mere 6 weeks beforehand, this girl was being groomed and abused by Walter Fair that she can see so deeply into her soul. Read so much into the uncertain tilt of her head, the slimness of her smile. She is amazed, in fact, that Brooke Ripley went to her school prom at all, given the horrific backdrop to it all. The Facebook post, which has been shared around 20 times, is a plea from Brooke's aunt, Fionn, writing on behalf of Brooke's mum. Alex reads the comments. They're all of the thoughts and prayers variety. Nobody has a clue. A girl called Mia, who was in the edges of the prom photograph with Brooke, replies, "That's me in the photo. Like, literally saw her just a few minutes before she disappeared. She said she was going home. Wish I knew where she was," accompanied by a sad face emoji and a heart. Alex clicks on Mia's profile and finds that it has maximum security settings, all the way down to blocking access to her friends list. She clicks on message and stares for a moment at the empty space in Messenger. What would she say? And how? And why, Alex wonders, has she never heard of Brooke Ripley? Why is her name and the photo of her in the beautiful white dress not synonymous with the summer of 2014? And then Alex realizes that in June 2014, she had a sleepless baby and a feisty six-year-old. She was deep down inside the well of early parenthood, so maybe she had seen this story around at the time and totally forgotten about it, or maybe it had been quickly subsumed by something bigger. She switches screens at the sound of footsteps down the stairs. It's Josie, still wearing the same outfit that Alex had lent to her on Saturday. It's now Wednesday. She has her own clothes hanging in her room, cleaned and ready to be worn, yet she is still wearing Alex's. "I was thinking," Alex says, "if you're going to be here for a couple more days, would you like me to go over to yours and pick up some clothes for you?" She sees a flash of something pass across Josie's face. "No," she says, her mouth set firm. "No, thank you." The weather's turning, though. It's going to be really hot the next couple of days, pushing 30. "I could pick you up some more of those summer dresses." "Honestly," Josie's mouth softens. "Honestly, it's fine." "Well, let me know if you change your mind." "Yes," says Josie, "I will." "And what will you do on Saturday? Where will you go?" She tries not to stare too hard at Josie as she finds her answer to this question, as she already knows that she will be struggling, already knows that Josie has no plan beyond the end of each day. "I suppose I'll..." She trails off momentarily. "I'm not sure. I mean, how would you feel..." Alex feels herself stiffen. "I notice there's a fold-out bed in the study. I mean, I could always sleep there while your sister's here. I don't suppose anyone will be using the study on a Saturday night. And I'd absolutely stay out of your way so that you and your sister can do sister things." Alex's mouth has turned dry. This is it. This is the line that she had put metaphorically inside her relationship with Josie from day one. And each day, they have been stepping a little closer and a little closer. And right now, they are touching it with their outstretched toes. And once that line has been breached, Alex no longer has any idea how she will regain control of the situation. She knows with a sickening certainty that she has to have Josie gone from her house by Saturday afternoon. But she also knows with a sickening certainty that Josie is currently controlling her and that making her leave the house before she's ready to do so would spell the end of the podcast, just as it was gearing up towards being something riveting and unmissable. She thinks all of this in the 2 seconds it takes for her to say, "Well, let me ask Nathan. I'm kicking him out of the girl's space on Saturday night, so he might well end up in the study, working." She glances quickly at Josie, long enough to observe a slightly menacing back tip of her head, a cool refinding of her bearings. "Well," she says. "Okay. But let me know as soon as you can." "Yes," Alex replies warmly. "Yes, of course." When Josie mentions that she won't be going into work that afternoon, Alex invents a reason to leave the house. Everything has been so intense since the moment that Josie and Walter walked into her house on Friday night. Every minute of every day has been overshadowed by the existence of these people and their horrible, messy lives, and by the physical presence of Josie and her dog in Alex's home. Time has lost its form and its meaning. Another weekend is approaching, and on the other side of that weekend is the end of the school term, and then there will be 6 long weeks of unstructured time and loose-limbed days, and she needs something which feels normal and just for her. She tells Josie she's going to return some library books, and then she heads into the park to have her lunch at the cafe. The cafe in Queen's Park has formed the basis of huge swathes of Alex's life since she and Nathan moved into the area 10 years ago. She sees ghosts and hears echoes of herself at all the different stages of herself. Pregnant with Leon, later sitting with a newborn and a 5-year-old, with mums from nursery, mums from school, with Nathan and the kids at the weekends. The ice cream kiosk makes her think of Leon and Eliza with bright blue mouths after eating the bubblegum flavour. The beers in the chilled cabinet make her think of the slightly woozy sensation of daytime drinking on hot summer afternoons. She sat at each table at various points, lived different versions of herself in multiple light refracting fragments. So today, she will sit in the cafe, and she will eat a panini, and she will live another fragment of her life, and she will try to feel normal. To feel like the Alex of 6 weeks ago. The Alex who hadn't met Josie Fair. She orders her panini, the one she always has, goat's cheese and ham, and she orders an iced tea, and she sits with her numbered wooden paddle on the table in front of her and waits for her food to arrive and waits to feel normal. But the normal doesn't come. Maybe normal is over there, she ponders. On the other side of the park somewhere. Maybe it's in the sandpit, where she still takes the kids sometimes when they're feeling little. Or maybe it's on the zip wire in the adventure playground, or in the petting zoo, which she and Nathan had walked past drunkenly on the night of her 45th birthday, the dark night air still warm on their bare skin. Her panini arrives, and it is the same panini she always has, but it doesn't bring her normal. It feels like Josie has taken Alex's normal and swallowed it deep down somewhere inside her darkness. Alex thinks of the blood-smeared key under the mattress with the number 6 scrawled on it. She thinks of Josie rooting through her recycling bin while she was out with her family. She thinks of Josie in her home right now, wearing Alex's clothes, Alex's makeup, scattering her hair, her dead skin cells, everywhere she goes. She pictures Josie going into their study, spotting the sofa bed, going into Alex's bathroom, taking her foundation. Then she sees Walter having sex with Brooke, Erin with her ear to the wall. Josie pretending it hadn't happened, getting on with her life. Alex pushes the panini away and gets to her feet. She needs to get this podcast finished. Get it done. Immerse herself in this filth. Get to the end of this miserable story. Get Josie out of her house and reclaim her life. But first, she needs to walk past Josie's flat, peer through the window, see if she can get a sense of what Walter might be doing or thinking.
12:30 p.m. Alex said she'd be gone for an hour. She said they'd do some recording when she returned if Josie was up for it. An hour is a long time, Josie thinks. A long time to be alone in someone's house. Alex told Josie to help herself to lunch.
Whatever's in the fridge, just help yourself.
So Josie peers into the fridge. She sees the rest of the baba, whatever it is, the brown stuff that made Fred sick. She shudders. Then she sees a block of cheddar and thinks that a piece of that and a slice of bread and butter will be all she needs. She eats the tiny lunch at the kitchen table, staring blankly into space. Fred snuffles around the kitchen, looking for crumbs. The floor is surprisingly messy. There has been the plastic twist from the top of a loaf of bread on the floor for 3 days now. Nobody seems to see it. It's not commensurate with the image that Alex likes to present on Instagram. None of it is, really. Not when you look up close. That doesn't matter. Josie's not naturally tidy herself. She's only tidy because Walter likes it that way, and so she feels happy for Alex that she's allowed to have a plastic bread bag tag on her floor for 3 days without it causing an argument. A moment later, she finds herself striding across the kitchen, picking up the tag and putting it in the pocket of her trousers. She opens and closes the silky smooth drawers in the kitchen until she gets to the messy one with all the things in it. She leafs through takeaway menus and biros and packets of Handy Andies and bulldog clips and books of postage stamps and bottle stoppers and rubber bands. Everything has been thrown in here. There is no order to any of it. Her fingers feel the sheen of a photograph and she pulls out a column of passport shots. They're of Leon, looking somber and serious, the pale blue collar of his school shirt just visible. She slides it into her pocket, too. She thinks of her underwear drawer, at home, of the trophies and trinkets tucked away behind her pants. Not just Alex's, the others, too. She feels an itch to go home, just for a moment, to tuck the child's drawing and the bread tag and the photos of Leon into the drawer. She could do that, she's sure. She'd be in and out in seconds. Nobody would see her. She'll go tomorrow, she decides. After work. And then she pulls out a shiny black business card with Nathan's details on it. The name of his company, Condor and Bright Commercial Property Consultants EC1, and his mobile phone number beneath his office number is printed on it. She puts it in her pocket.
Can you see down my top at this angle?
No, you're fine.
Good. Well then, let's go.
This is Caitlin Rand.
Well, I wouldn't say I was a friend of Josie's. I knew of her. She knew of me. I lived on her estate when I was small, and I remember her and her mum. Particularly her mum. Everyone knew Pat O'Neill. She was larger than life. You didn't want to get on the wrong side of her. And I remember my mum telling me about Josie suddenly leaving home at 18, and the gossip that went round at the time that she'd gone off with an older man. Last time I saw her, I guess I was about 10. And I didn't see her again for years and years. Until I brought some stuff into that shop where she worked. Stitch, the alterations place in Kilburn, and I recognised her immediately. She hadn't changed at all, weirdly. Pretty sure she was still wearing the same clothes she used to wear when she was a teenager. So I got chatting with her, and she asked me what I did, and I told her about the acting. I told her I was struggling. You know, as actors do. Made light of it. And she said, and these were her exact words, "I might have a gig for you. Give me your number." So I gave her my number and then, yeah, A few days later, she called me. And that was that. Up to my neck in it. Up to my fucking neck.
...12:40 p.m. It's a 12-minute walk from the lush greenness of Queen's Park to the stained grey of Josie's Street. Even on a sunny day, the stucco houses look humiliated by their poor condition. Alex stares first from across the street, and then from outside, directly into the windows. She sees a table in the bay. It's a dark wood, the sort that is unfashionable these days. There are three dark wooden chairs around it with barley twist spindles. She can make out a sofa facing towards an older-looking television. Blank walls. A kitchen open to the living room is built into an alcove at the back. The cabinets are pine-clad with white plastic handles. She can make out a dark passageway leading to a door. Denim curtains are half-drawn over the smaller window. Through the gap, she can see a bed, freshly made with a pale floral duvet and two floral pillows, a pair of denim cushions, some white formica-clad drawers. It looks like a rental that's just been vacated by its previous owners, spruced up and tidied and dressed for its next occupants. It does not look like a flat that is currently being lived in. She goes back to the big bay window, casts her eyes around the room again. It is hard to believe that a domestic incident occurred here in the early hours of Saturday, that a big man beat his small wife until she was bloodied and bruised. And where is that big man? She wonders. There is a laptop closed on the dining table, but nothing else. Josie described him as never going out, as always being home, but he is not home now. So where is he? She looks one more time at the sofa. She pictures Walter and Josie sitting side by side in the aftermath of his atrocity with Brooke, silently watching TV. Then she pictures Walter, 5 years later, slamming his wife's head against the wall in rage at her belated accusations. As she turns back, she looks slightly to her left. She sees a double-decker bus rumbling down Kilburn High Road a few hundred feet away, heading south towards Maida Vale. And as she sees it, she thinks of Brooke Ripley climbing off a bus in her white column dress 5 years ago, just there. Just there, in fact, at the point where Kilburn High Road meets Maida Vale. Just there. A 2-minute walk from Josie and Walter's flat. 2 p.m. Alex stares hard at Josie. She tries to make her face look soft, but it's difficult because inside she feels all hard edges and spikes and darkness. Josie has her headphones on and is drinking tea out of Alex's favourite mug. Alex suspects that Josie knows it is Alex's favourite mug, and that is why she always uses it. Alex adjusts the volume on the controls and then clears her throat, watching the lines jumping on the screen of her laptop. Her next question feels solid on her tongue, like something that she might accidentally swallow and choke on. She clears her throat again and says, "So, what happened to Brooke?" "Brooke?" Alex smiles and nods. "Yes, Brooke." "I have no idea. Never heard from her again." "Never heard from her again?" "No." "Did you never try to find her?" Josie narrows her eyes at Alex and throws her a questioning look. "No. Why would I, after what she did?" "Well, maybe she might have had some sort of an idea about where Roxy was." Alex watches Josie's face as she reaches for a reply. "No," she says after a pause. "No, she wouldn't have known. They had that big fallout. It was all over between them, completely." Alex raises an eyebrow coolly, finding it virtually impossible to cover her feelings. "How would you feel," she says, "about me getting in touch with Brooke? Getting her side of things, for the podcast?" "No." It's as immediate and definite as a slammed door.
Why not?
Because... just no, it's too much. I'm telling you what I want to tell you. What I need to tell you. I have to live my life on the other side of this podcast, you know? Show my face in the world. And if you get her involved... She stops and inhales. Alex waits. I just don't trust her, that's all. You must wonder, though, what happened to her. Of course I do. I wonder all the time. About Roxy. And about Brooke. All the time. It's like my life. It's like it ended that day, you know? Like all the good things stopped. But Erin, Alex says, what about Erin? What about Erin? I mean, she must bring you happiness, surely. What was it like for her when Roxy left? You barely talk about Erin. Josie shrugs. There's not much to say. Well, should we just try? Josie nods.
This is a recording from Alex Summers' podcast, captured on the 17th of July, 2019.
After the Brooke thing, my relationship with Walter became a game of chess. It was like I was a pawn, being pushed about by some huge invisible finger from square to square with no thought of my needs and wants. Walter was the king, of course, and everything in the home was done to protect him. I'd created a kind of invisible barrier around my family behind the door of our flat. I'd been doing it for years, of course. All throughout the 14 years of the children being at school, with the mums and the teachers and the social workers and my work colleagues, and the next door and upstairs neighbours, I kept people away. But that was when nobody had really done anything wrong. When all I was worried about was being judged for having badly behaved children, violent husband. But now I was in danger of being judged for having a husband who seduced teenage girls and slept with them in his own home. And yes, I did go onto his laptop. And yes, he had been looking at things that were illegal and disgusting and actually very upsetting. And yes, Walter is a pervert and a criminal, disgusting, repellent, a man that I would never touch again, not in that way. And I told him as much. Told him that that side of our marriage was over. So I cooked and cleaned and worked and smiled at people I trusted, kept my head down around people I didn't, and then 2 years ago I told Walter I wanted a dog because I was sick of not having anything to love. And he said if we were going to get a dog, then he wanted an Akita or a Doberman or something he could feel proud of walking down the road. And I said, no, this dog is for me, and I want a dog I can carry like a baby because you ruined my babies. You ruined them. Because by then, not only had Roxy gone, but Walter had started abusing Erin.
Two thirty PM. Abusing? What do you mean? Josie tips her head back slightly and rolls her eyes to the ceiling. Alex waits with her breath caught painfully at the back of her throat. She feels as if she'd known this all along, somehow. Like this had been a terrible hum in the background of everything right from the very start. I mean that nearly every night when I fall asleep, Walter gets out of bed and goes into Erin's room. And then, when I get up, he's sitting at the table in the living room acting like nothing happened. And? I mean, how do you know? I just do. That man thinks he's the king, you see. He lets me have my way here and there, like with the dog, like coming here for dinner. But he does it in the way that a king would do it. A throne treat, she gestures with her arm. You have to run for it, you know. But as far as he's concerned, everything in that flat is his. It all belongs to him. And so the minute I told him I wasn't his anymore, that he was no longer allowed to touch me, he took the next nearest thing. He took Erin. Have you ever seen anything? Heard anything? Josie shakes her head. I put in my earplugs. I stay in my room until the morning comes. Fuck, Josie! Alex can't help it. She cannot contain the shock and dismay. She's meant to be impartial. Her job is not to judge or react, but simply to ask and listen. But this, she'll edit out her reaction, she knows that. This is too animal and raw to remain circumspect about, especially, and yes, yeah, she knows it's the most awful cliche, but especially as a mother. What was I meant to do? Josie snaps. It was so gradual. I didn't realise at first what was happening. I just happened to wake up a couple of times and see the empty bed. I'd ask him where he'd been and he'd say he'd been chatting online with his kids in Canada, and I thought, why does it have to be in the middle of the night? What's wrong with the evening? And once I'd worked out what was happening, well, I thought she'd come and tell me. Erin. I kept waiting. But instead, she just went more and more into herself. Stopped eating anything I gave her. She'd always been fussy, but she got fussier and then started asking for baby food. Baby food? Yes, she said. I want that stuff I used to have when I was little. The stuff you gave me out of a jar when you used to feed me with a spoon. I mean, I assumed it was some kind of, what do they call it? Regression, I suppose. She wanted to be a baby again, to be safe. But Josie, oh, sorry, Alex interjects, sensing that Josie is skimming over vast swathes of important backstory. What did Walter say? I mean, you must have said something to him, surely. Josie shakes her head and Alex sighs so loudly it makes the audio display on her laptop oscillate wildly. I'm really sorry, Josie. Really, I am, but I need to get this straight. You are telling me that in the aftermath of what happened with Walter and Brooke, your youngest daughter ran away from home and you withdrew conjugal favours from your husband, and that as a result of that, your husband started to visit your older teenage daughter in her bedroom every night to, you assume, sexually abuse her. Your daughter began to regress to the point of wanting to eat only baby food and stopped leaving her room entirely. And this has been going on for the past 5 years. Around about, yes. Josie's voice is clipped. Her mouth is pursed. And you have not spoken to either your daughter or your husband about it. She nods. That's correct. It just happens. It just happens. And your daughter, Erin, was she restrained in any way? I mean, was she free to leave? Yes, she was free to leave. But she didn't. No, she didn't. And why do you think that is? He probably got inside her head. He probably made her think it was okay. The way he does, you know? Alex leaves a moment of silence. Her listeners will need it at this point, but she needs it too. Then she asks the question that she fears the answer to. Before Friday night, Josie, when you and Walter had your fight, the night Walter beat you, when was the last time you'd seen Erin? She shrugs. She sniffs and wriggles slightly in her chair. About 6 months. Maybe a year. About that. Not at all. Not once, not even going to the bathroom. She waits until I'm not in the house. She doesn't want to see me. But how do you know that? Well, she'd come and see me if she did, wouldn't she? She knows when I'm there. I feed her. I leave her the food and then she puts the empties outside her room. And don't think for a minute that I didn't want to see her, because I wanted to see her more than anything. But when something goes on for that long, it just gets harder and harder, doesn't it? Harder to turn back and do the right thing. I stopped at her door every day, twice, three times a day. I stopped and I touched the door and I made my hand like this. She forms it into a fist with knuckles. Like I was going to knock. And I never did, Alex. I just never did. And don't think I don't hate myself, because I hate myself so much. So much. Hate that it took so long for me to break this, to stop it. And it took a dinner at my house. Yes, like I told you when we first met up, it was all about breaking patterns. Going to the fancy pub that night, getting rid of the denim, getting to know you, doing this. She gestures at the space between them. It was as if I had to break small patterns before I would be ready to break big ones. Alex nods slowly and peers at Josie through narrowed eyes. I see, she says, although she really doesn't. I see. But you say that Erin has been a virtual recluse for the past few months, hasn't left her room or the house. So where did she go exactly on Friday night? Which friend has she gone to stay with? Josie repositions herself. I have no idea. Someone she went to school with? Oh, I doubt that. No, probably just someone she knows from gaming, an online friend. You must be so worried about her. Yes, I am. I'm horribly worried about her. I'm worried about her, and I'm worried about Roxy. And what about Walter? Are you worried about Walter? God, no. Why would I be worried about him? He's a pervert and a wife beater. He's a monster. I despise him. I absolutely despise him. I'm glad. She stops herself short. Glad what? I'm glad he hit me. I'm glad he hurt me. It got me out of there. Got me out of that sick prison. I'd take the beating all over again to be free. Her face sets hard, and Alex wishes this was a documentary, not a podcast. She wishes her listeners could see the way Josie's face has frozen into a mask, and the single glycerine tear that appears in those black eyes of hers and spills down her cheek in a straight line. What will become of him? Of Walter? Will you tell the police about what he did to Erin? She wipes the tear away with the back of her hand and sniffs. No, she says. That's not my move to make. That's up to Erin. Have you talked to her about it? No. I haven't spoken to her at all. She won't take my calls or reply to my messages. Alex makes a circle of her mouth and exhales. None of this makes any sense. None of it. Have you thought about going to the flat and going through Erin's computer, seeing what you can find? I don't know anything about computers. Well, yes, but I do. I could come with you. No. No, thank you. Erin will come to me when she's ready. But Josie, think about it. Erin has been abused under your roof for years. You've done nothing to protect her. She waits until you're out of the house before she uses the bathroom. What on earth makes you think she's going to get in touch with you? Josie sighs and shrugs. You're probably right, she says. I'm sure you're right. But whatever happens, it's better for her than being in that flat with that man. Whatever happens, at least she's free. 3:30 p.m. Alex stands outside the school gates. She has brought the dog, who has not been taken for a walk yet today. She wanted an excuse to leave a little early, to be out a little late. Her head is bursting. She feels sick. Mothers chat with her and she chats back, glad of the opportunity to take herself completely out of the place she spent the past few hours. The dog sees another dog and yaps at it, and Alex apologises to the dog's owner. Children fuss around the tiny dog and Alex says, "Be careful, he can be a bit snappy." Someone asks if the dog is hers and she says, "No, he belongs to a friend," then corrects herself and says, "To someone I know." She takes the children to the park and watches them on the swings, the dog tucked under her arm. She wishes the dog could talk. Dog would know, she thinks. The dog would know everything. She wants to talk to Josie's mum, but she has promised Josie that she won't. She can't stop thinking about Walter, about the way he'd been on Friday night when he came for dinner. The brand new clothes, with the creases still in. The moderate drinking, he had only two beers all night. The quiet way he'd talked to her in her recording studio about his Jojo. About her lying and her making up stories to suit her own narrative. She'd put it down to the behaviour of a gaslighter. She'd assumed that it was all part of his act. And maybe it was. But she can't shift the discomforting sense that there's something else. Something behind this dark yet somehow typical story of a family blighted by the dysfunction of a controlling and dominant man. She's not who she makes out to be. Not at all. That's what he'd said. And as much as her gut tells her to believe a woman who says she has been abused, it also tells her that Josie is not to be trusted.
Thursday, the 18th of July. Alex and the children have left for school, but Nathan is running late for work. Josie had heard him say something to Alex about a meeting in Bishopsgate at 10 a.m. Not worth him heading to the office beforehand. Just as Alex had predicted, the weather has turned from pleasant for mid-July to unbearably hot. Nathan sits in the garden with his laptop and a cup of coffee, and even from here, Josie can see the sheen of sweat on his forehead. It occurs to her that he sits in the garden in the mornings deliberately to avoid having to share space with her indoors. She forces a smile and slips through the gap between the sliding glass doors. She's still wearing the clothes that Alex gave her on Saturday. She has her own clothes hanging in her room, but she no longer wants to wear them, even though they are clean. She had hoped that Alex might take pity on her, seeing her descend the stairs every morning wearing the same top and trousers, that she might offer to lend her something new. But she hasn't. "God," she says, standing a few feet from Nathan. "It's boiling, and it's not even 9 o'clock.
"They're saying 32 by lunchtime."
"Bloody hell."
She allows a silence to pass before turning to him and saying,
"Oh, by the way, Alex said you might be using the study on Saturday night when her sister is here."
"Oh," he says, looking slightly flustered, and Josie knows immediately that he and Alex have been talking about this secretly, privately, behind her back.
"Well, yeah, that was the plan, but no, apparently they're all sleeping over now."
"I think Alex was going to tell you.
Both sisters and all three kids, they're going to be using the fold-out, so..."
He clears his throat and trails off.
"Lies. All of it."
"Oh," says Josie, "that's fine, I'll find something. But what about you? Where will you be hiding out?"
"Oh, I'll probably hang out here for a bit and then head off around 7 for a couple of drinks with some mates."
"The same mates you were with when you didn't show up for dinner last Friday."
She tries to inject a hint of playfulness into her words, but she fails. She's so cross she could scream.
He throws her an uncertain look
and shrugs.
"I'm not sure yet," he says. "I'm not sure."
Then he necks the dregs of his coffee, slaps his hand against his legs and says,
"Well, time for me to head into work."
"What are you up to today?"
"Nothing, really. We'll do some more of the podcast, then I'll go to work. That's it, really."
"And what are your plans, Josie?"
"Generally. I mean, obviously from Saturday you'll need a plan,
won't you?"
Josie eyes him coolly.
He has gone off script, she can tell. This is not what Alex told him to say. This is, she thinks furiously, none of his bloody business.
But she manages to sound civil when she says,
"Yes, I'll need a plan."
"But what I've found, Nathan, is that life shows you the way when you forget to make one.
So, you know, let's wait and see."
She shrugs and heads back into the kitchen, scoops up the dog and takes him to her room, where she waits until she hears the sound of Nathan slamming the front door behind him
a few minutes later. She watches him
through the small window in her bedroom, slinging his suit jacket over his shoulder, sliding his stupid sunglasses onto his stupid nose, walking down the street as if he were the king of the universe. Alex said she was going to the shops after the school run. She said she'd be home about 9:30. It's 9:10 a.m. now, and Josie shuts the dog in her room and tiptoes down to the next floor. Alex and Nathan's bedroom door is wide open, which she feels is a sign of some sort that Alex isn't precious about people seeing inside. She hasn't properly investigated their room yet.
It feels too much. Much too much.
But Nathan has put her in a bad mood with all his talk of plans.
If Nathan thinks she should have a plan, she decides, then a plan she will have.
Alex and Nathan's bed is very big. It has a bedhead made out of rattan and pale green velvet. It is unmade. Huge, voluminous clouds of creamy duvet are bunched up at the foot of the bed, kicked off, no doubt, during the encroaching heat of the previous night, with two fat pillows squashed into fortune cookies at the top end, and two more kicked onto the floor on either side. The walls are hung with a mishmash of prints and paintings and photographs. A pair of milky white lights hang from the ceiling, one on each side of the bed, instead of table lamps, Josie supposes. There's a square bay window with a little seat built into it, overlooking the back garden. It's scattered with discarded clothes, mostly Nathan's, including a nasty-looking pair of threadbare socks. You'd think he could afford new ones. Between the bedroom and the ensuite bathroom is a kind of anteroom, or dressing area, with clothes hanging on either side, Alex's on one, Nathan's on the other. She spends a minute or two leafing through Alex's clothes. She rubs the fabrics between her fingers, the silks and linens and soft bamboo cottons. She pulls open the shoe drawers beneath and looks at the neat rows of golden strappy sandals and suede-heeled boots and silken heels with ankle straps. She wants to take them out and try them on, admire herself in the full-length mirror, but the minutes are ticking by. So she turns to Nathan's rail and starts feeling through his pockets. She doesn't know what she's looking for precisely, but she has a very strong feeling that Nathan is stupid enough and Alex is trusting enough for her to find something she will need. She pulls out crumpled paper receipts and business cards and empty chewing gum packages. She pulls out paper clips and sugar packets and the wrinkled paper tubes from drinking straws, boarding passes for flights to Brussels and Dublin, a comb half a polo mint. And then... yes, there. Right there. In the inside pocket of a blue business jacket, exactly what she was looking for. A tiny clear bag with a residue of white powder clinging to its insides. She pictures him now, in a bar, his tie slung over his shoulder, surrounded by tequila shots and baying men, snorting cocaine off a glass-topped table. Despicable, she thinks. Just despicable. With a wife and children at home. In another pocket, she finds a scrap of paper napkin with an illegible number written on it. And in another, a cardboard sleeve for a hotel key card, the railings, with the room number 23 written on it. She takes all three items and puts them in her pocket, goes back to her room, and waits for Alex to come home. Nathan wants her to have a plan. Well, now she's got one. Alex returns a few minutes later. She is laden with bags from the supermarket, and Josie watches her unload them onto the island in the kitchen. Melon and strawberry fruit bowl, crunchy nut cornflakes, a huge steak, a bag of onions, pouches of cat food with pictures on them of a cat that looks exactly like the cloud cat, as if Alex's cat has had her very own personalised dinner designed for her. I'll go to my mum's, Josie says to Alex, on Saturday, when your sisters come. Alex stops what she's doing, a cylinder of chocolate biscuits held aloft in her hand. Oh, she says. Okay, that's great. What changed your mind about getting in touch with her? Josie shrugs and pulls out a tiny loose hair from Fred's fur, lets it float lazily to the floor. I didn't really have a choice, I suppose. I mean, Nathan told me about your other sister coming to stay, so I know the fold-out bed will be taken. Though I thought your other sister lived in London. Yes. Yes, she does, but her kids didn't want to miss out on the fun. They wanted to sleep over too, so yes, I'm sorry about that. A bit of a last-minute thing. But I'm so glad you're going to see your mum. I really think it's time. Josie nods, as though she has given Alex's words serious thought and now agrees with her. It is what it is, she says. But while I'm still here, we've got two more days. We should make the most of them. You mean the podcast? Yes. We should try and get as much down on tape as we can. Josie feels her heart pick up under the cotton of Alex's expensive t-shirt at the thought of next week. She feels the heat in the air, the sun burning already as it starts its arc across the empty sky and blazes through the glass roof of Alex's kitchen extension, and it's only going to get hotter. By Sunday, it will be pushing 35. She thought she'd have longer. She's running out of time. She glances up to see Alex staring thoughtfully at her. I'm not sure what else there is to chat about now. I mean, we got to the end, I think. We're up to date. Apart from the events of Friday night, of course, would you like to talk about that?
Josie nods, her mouth tightly pursed.
Shall we? Alex gestures to the studio.
Yes,
says Josie. Let's.
This is a recording from Alex Summers' podcast, captured on the 18th of July, 2019.
He hadn't wanted to go in the first place. Made such a fuss. I bought him some nice new clothes, but he refused to wear them, insisted on wearing cheap stuff from Primark, deliberately got a terrible haircut just to spite me.
And then, of course, when Nathan didn't make an appearance. Well, you could see how annoyed he was. And then he seethed. The whole walk home, I could feel it coming off him. The dark rage building and building. By the time we got home, the atmosphere was putrid. I couldn't control my anger by that point. I felt it all of it, rolling and churning through me like a storm. And finally, after all these years, I found the strength to hurl it out of my gut and into the air. To hit Walter with it, right between the eyes. I just screamed at him. Paedophile. You're a paedophile. You groomed me and you took me when I was too young to know what I wanted. And then you groomed Brooke and you took her when she was too young to know what she wanted. And then you abused your own daughter, the only daughter you have left after what you did to Roxy. You have abused your daughter over and over again. And I have let you do that because I've been programmed by you to believe that you are God and that you can have anything you want. But you are not God, Walter. And you cannot have anything you want. You cannot. And it stops tonight. What you're doing to Erin, it stops tonight. No more. No more. And then I ran to Erin's door and I pushed it open and there was my baby, my Erin, staring at me from wide, dead eyes. I said, pack a bag, baby. Quickly, I'm getting you out of here. We're leaving. I said, I know what Dad's been doing and I'm so, so sorry, baby. So sorry that I abandoned you. And that was when I felt it. A blow to the back of my head. Then a kind of deep radiating heat and pain and wetness. I turned and saw Walter's arm coming back towards me with the remote control he'd just used to hit me with held in his hand coming towards my face and then he beat me with it all over my face and head. Erin just stood there, so thin she was, so thin. And I threw myself towards Walter and shoved him in his chest with both my hands outstretched and said, enough, that is enough. And I saw him raise his hand to hit my child and I just flung myself between them. And then, as quickly as it had started, it stopped. A moment later, I peered into the living room. Walter was sitting at his laptop. The remote control was sitting on the coffee table. It was like he was trying to give the impression that none of it had ever happened. Like I didn't have a split lip and blood seeping down the back of my neck. It was as if he thought we were all just going to carry on normally, like we always did. But he was wrong. I grabbed my handbag. I grabbed the dog, I grabbed Erin, and we left. Neither of us said goodbye.
...11 a.m. Alex exhales. She has not breathed for what felt like minutes. The scenario that Josie has painted inside her head is making her feel claustrophobic, as if she is trapped in that dark, shabby flat with all three of them. She can smell it inside her nostrils, the fear and the blood. She pictures them on the street, Josie and Erin carrying just what they grabbed as they left, the blood congealing on Josie's face, Walter still and unrepentant in the bay window. But that is where the picture starts to fragment. Josie walked from her home near Kilburn the 16 minutes to Alex's house in Queen's Park. But it was 3 a.m. when she appeared on Alex's doorstep. It was cold. What had happened between 10 o'clock, when they would have returned home, and 3 a.m. when Josie arrived here? She glances up at Josie and says, "Where did you go when you left the flat?" Josie issues a small laugh. "Well, here, obviously." "But in between?" "Nowhere." "But you said that the argument started when you got home, and it only lasted a few minutes. I just..." Josie interjects. "No, It didn't happen when we got home. I didn't say that. It happened when Walter got out of bed, like he does nearly every night, like I told you. We went to bed and then I couldn't sleep. It took me ages. And then finally I dropped off and I felt him. I felt him peel back the covers. I knew what he was doing, where he was going. And that was when I confronted him. So you were in bed, in your pajamas? Yes. And then you got up and followed him? Yes. I saw him going to Erin's door, and that was when I screamed at him. But you weren't wearing your pajamas when you came to me. You were wearing the dress, the lovely dress. I put it back on. I wasn't going to walk halfway across Kilburn in my pajamas. But the dress had blood on it. How did the dress have blood on it if you weren't wearing it during the attack? Alex, I don't understand what you're trying to say. Are you saying that you don't believe me? No, not at all. Of course not, but listeners are going to be hearing this like it's a novel. They'll notice plot holes. You and I have been having this conversation for a month, but listeners will be gobbling this down in a day once it's out there and edited down. It needs to make sense. For the listener. Do you see? Josie sighs deeply. Oh, yes, I suppose. But you think that the sort of people who listen to your stuff would have more sympathy? Some empathy? You'd think they'd understand that when something like that happens, like what's happened to me, when someone has been the victim of abuse and violence and gaslighting, that maybe they might get a bit confused. Yes, Josie, yes, of course, that's absolutely true. So I just want to help you to unpick it all a bit and then put it back together so that it makes sense, that's all. So Walter got out of bed in the early hours. You accosted him. He attacked you. He tried to attack Erin. Then you and Erin collected a few things. You got redressed and then you both left together. Josie nods firmly. Yes. And you walked here, and Erin? Where did Erin walk? The opposite direction. At 3 a.m? Yes. Did she have things with her? Oh, I suppose so, yes, a small bag. Alex smiles glassily at Josie. She wants to push through. She wants to understand how Josie could have left her vulnerable daughter to walk somewhere, God knows where, all alone in the middle of the night. She wants to know. But she can tell that Josie is shutting down now, pulling up her drawbridge. She sighs. I hope Erin is okay. It's very scary thinking of her all alone in the night. Yes, Josie replies firmly. But she's safer out there than she ever was in her own home. Wherever she is, she's safe. She says this with a strange certainty, as if the world were not full of dangerous people who prey on the vulnerable, as if nothing bad could possibly have happened to her daughter between 3 o'clock on a Saturday morning and now. I really think we should try to track her down, Josie. It's been nearly 6 days. No messages, no calls. I know she's safe from Walter now, but it is possible she might have found herself somewhere worse. Maybe her online friend wasn't who they claimed to be. I mean, you hear that sort of thing a lot, don't you? People with fake online identities. It's just, she's fine, Alex. She's fine. She can take care of herself. But you said she can't. You said you've been feeding her baby food. You said, Alex flinches as Josie pulls off her headphones and slams them on the tabletop. I'm trying to tell you my story, Alex. My truth. And you seem to be trying to make it into something it isn't. You either want my story or you don't. You can't have it both ways. You just can't. And then she picks up her dog from her lap and storms out of the recording studio, leaving Alex reeling in her wake.